It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. In a few moments, an update from Afghanistan on the killing of two U.S. military officers shot dead inside the Interior Ministry in Kabul. And later, former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi escapes jail time once again. But back to our cover story today. There's a lot of confusion over why gas prices have suddenly spiked. As we mentioned earlier, domestic production of oil is at an 8-year high, and demand for gas is at its lowest in over a decade. But the national average for a gallon of unleaded is now $3.60. NPR's economics correspondent John Itzde is here to explain. John, it's great to have you here. Thanks for being
here. Nice to be here, Guy.
Okay, so some of the arguments that analysts are raising are as follows. Iran, instability with what's going on in the Middle East, Wall Street speculators, and then some people are pointing to the Obama administration's policies on drilling, on things like rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline that we've just been hearing about. Is that true? Is that why gas prices are going up?
Well, some of those reasons, I think, are true. But those aren't the only things. And there are some other big things going on. For instance, a number of companies, Sunoco, Conoco, Hess, have all shut down refineries in the U.S., cutting off 5% of U.S. gasoline production.
Huh.
And the big reason is that these refineries are outmoded and unprofitable. They're old refineries. They haven't been updated to refined high-sulfur crude oil, so they can't compete with the other refineries. So there's a shortage of gasoline. Interestingly, there's not a shortage of crude oil itself.
Oh, well, this is so fascinating. And tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about all the crude oil that's stored in Cushing, Oklahoma. There's a glut of crude oil in the United States, and yet demand is going down and prices are going up. Usually when you study economics, it's prices go up when demand goes up.
That's right. But in this case, what's happened is that the U.S., for the first time in 60 years, since before you were born, has become a net exporter of gasoline. We're sending more gasoline out than we're bringing in. And it's because the price of gasoline, relative to the rest of the world, is much lower. We're paying higher prices. But the cost of producing gas in the United States is so much lower that the U.S. is now a net exporter of gasoline.
So wouldn't it make sense to keep more of that gasoline in the United States, not export as much, and try to keep prices lower here? Is that possible?
Well, it's not really possible because it's a free market. But the question is, so why is it so much cheaper for U.S. refiners to produce gasoline?
Right.
And the answer to that question opens the door to the most important long-term story here, even more important than the price Americans are paying at the pump today. The reason U.S. companies can produce gasoline so cheaply is because we've got this huge amount of natural gas that's been developed over the last 3 years because of these controversial techniques like fracking.
Yeah.
And so there's this abundance of cheap fuel that U.S. refiners can use to crack crude oil into gasoline.
Mm.
And so the rest of the world sees this. They want our gasoline. They're bidding up the price, and we're paying a bigger price at the pump. And, Guy, you know, oil refiners are just one example of the manufacturers in the U.S. who are being made more globally competitive because they have access to cheap and abundant natural gas to run their factories. So it's a big deal for the whole economy.
That's NPR economics correspondent John Itzde. John, thanks so much for the explanation.
You're welcome.
No matter who wins an Oscar tonight, undoubtedly at least one acceptance speech will go on too long, and the orchestra will get its cue, as Cuba Gooding Jr. found out the hard way back in 1997 after winning Best Supporting Actor for his role in the film Jerry Maguire.
God, I love you. Hallelujah. Thank you, Father God, for putting me through what you put me through, but I'm here and I'm happy. The studio, I love you, and Cameron Crowe.
Getting played off the stage is by now an Oscar tradition. Ian Chillog and Mike Danforth of NPR's How to Do Everything podcast explain just how it works.
Just so you can keep us straight, I'm Mike.
And I'm Ian. Now, everybody always wants to blame the conductor for playing the winners off.
You may remember Julia Roberts even got mad at him.
And sir, you're doing a great job, but you're so quick with that stick, so why don't you sit? Because I may never be here again.
But here's the thing. It's not the conductor's fault.
It's not the music director that's making that call.
That's Bill Ross. He was the music director at last year's Oscars.
It's the director of the show, the producer of the show. People think that it's the music director or the guy with the baton that's making this call, and I can assure you it's not.
Every conductor has their own special song they use for this purpose. In Bill Ross's case,
it's literally called Too Long. and it's always sitting there on the stand, and it's very simple.
The song Too Long is specifically orchestrated to make it harder and harder to talk over.
So, Bill, let's try this. We'll play a speech, and you kind of tell us what's going on in your headset and in the pit as the speaker's talking.
4 score and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty.
All right, let's get ready to play this guy off.
Okay. Whether that nation so conceived and so
piano
needed can long
plays, be it's playing, it's we slowly getting a little bit louder. And then on cue, I'll bring in the strings so they start to build. We're getting more and more volume. Hopefully, they're getting the message. And then at a certain point, the brass come in and it's orchestrated big and rich and hard to talk to. And hopefully, by then, they've wrapped up their speech and they're gone.
If they fail to get the speaker off the stage, they dim the lights.
They'll cut your mic.
And go to commercial.
They won't, however, tase you.
Yeah, we asked.
But before the orchestra became the established way of getting people off stage, they had other ways of doing it.
Here's historian Jim Piazza talking about the 1956 Oscars, when Dorothy Malone won Best Supporting Actress.
She went on for 5 minutes and something, and nothing they could do could stop her. And finally, Jerry Lewis rushed out and took out his pocket watch and just swung it in front of her face. And that was her cutoff.
Even though music is probably more polite than Jerry Lewis, the conductors still feel terrible about it.
Bill, last year you played off Colleen Atwood, who won Best Costume Design for her work on Alice in Wonderland. We can forward on a message. Yeah. Anything you want to say to her?
Colleen, I'm so sorry. As far as I'm concerned, you can stand out there and talk as long as you want.
Hey, Colleen, does that help?
Well, that is very kind of him. I should thank Bill for that apology, and with all the understanding of a fellow person behind the scenes.
Remember, when you're watching tonight, it's not the conductor's fault.
No, it's the director.
Yeah, blame him.
For NPR, I'm Mike Danforth.
And I'm Ian Chillog.
Ian and Mike will be live blogging the Oscars red carpet with some of the other good folks from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's billed as style commentary from people who have none. Tonight at NPR.org.
James Fallows is away for the next few weeks, but we're delighted to welcome Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page to our studios for more on the stories behind the headlines. Clarence, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Guy. Great to be here.
John Idstey just explained some of the reasons behind the rising gas prices, but let me ask about the politics here. All signs seem to suggest the White House is very nervous about this issue. We're talking about a classic pocketbook issue for many voters.
They're very concerned, and it does show. The president was brave in political terms in telling people the truth, that he has no silver bullet. And in fact, they tend to be cyclical. Back in 2008, that was an important factor during the campaign between Obama and John McCain.
Right.
At that time, gas prices were going up, and that just added to the economic misery out there, especially with swing voters who tend to be suburban. And guess what? Suburbanites tend to drive a lot.
Indeed. And of course, if we're talking about $4 a gallon gas prices in the summer, when the election season really starts to heat up, that could be bad news for him.
It could be. And I think the White House is hoping that the usual cycle occurs where you have gas prices going up early summer, people going on vacation, driving around a lot, and that they cycle back down toward the fall. What's really critical is Labor Day and after. Mm. That's when, especially those swing voters, those late deciders are making up their minds.
Well, let's talk about some of those voters because we're, of course, looking forward to the Michigan primary on Tuesday.
Right.
This is Mitt Romney's home state where his dad was the governor.
That's right.
And yet he is facing a strong challenge from Rick Santorum there.
Yeah, this is his state where he's really viewed as a favorite son, and people were expecting this to be a fairly easy win for him. Well, quite the opposite has happened. As the campaign train has moved toward Michigan, Rick Santorum was on top of the polls and has still been running strong. But I think after this debate this past week, Mitt Romney has some new strength. He's got some new momentum, and he has an advertising budget that's three times the size of Rick
right.
Santorum's, then that means he's been pummeling Santorum with attack ads.
He has to win in Michigan, or else it'll be very embarrassing for him, obviously.
Well, that's our conventional wisdom,
yes.
Guy. But I tell you, how much has our conventional wisdom been side
right,
rails, you
right,
know?
Right.
You know, I still think, and this based on talking with a lot of experts and insiders out there, that Mitt Romney in the long run is still the favorite. But
yeah.
Yeah, you're right. If he doesn't win Michigan, though, that's a very big hole in the road for him to stumble over.
Clarence, some eyebrows were raised this week when former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, arguably among the most influential Republicans in the country, he said that he found some of the rhetoric he's been hearing from the GOP presidential candidates is, quote, troubling. He even wondered whether he'd be considered a conservative anymore.
And he clarified later, said, yes, I am a conservative. But when he was speaking, he was saying this in terms of how the way you traditionally define a conservative, suddenly that's not the definition of the more extreme parts of the Republican Party. And the fact is, the Tea Party has energized the Republicans over the last couple of years. And to them, their version of conservatism, Ronald Reagan would have a very tough time meeting that standard nowadays. The significance of Jeb Bush's remarks is that this is a voice from the Republican establishment. Mm. You've been hearing about the Republican establishment and how Mitt Romney was their favorite all along here, but you haven't been hearing from them very much.
Right.
And those who we know are members of that establishment have not spoken out much. Here you see Jeb Bush just kind of off the cuff, seemingly, speaking out and saying what a lot of folks have been saying in private in the party, that if they get a candidate who's too conservative, they're going to have a very tough time winning those swing voters in November.
And we'll be sure to put Jeb Bush's point to Newt Gingrich, who will be on the program tomorrow. So we'll see what he has to say about
it. Looking
that.
Forward to that.
That's Clarence Page. He's a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, thanks so much and hope you come back soon.
I look forward to it, Guy. Thank you.
From NPR News, it's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Here's a question. Why is the price of gas all of a sudden going up? At this gas station here in Washington, D.C., a gallon of regular unleaded is $3.86. That's 12% higher than this time last year. And there's a pretty good chance that soon it'll reach an average of $4 a gallon nationally. But why now? Demand is at the lowest in over a decade, and domestic oil production is at an 8-year high. Well, some analysts attribute the higher prices to tension with Iran. Others point to speculators on Wall Street. And then there are those who say it's all about President Obama's policies. In particular, a decision the president took late last month to deny a permit for a massive oil pipeline. It's called Keystone XL. It's a pipeline that would travel more than 2,000 miles from one of the biggest oil deposits in the world in Alberta, Canada, all the way down to the Gulf Coast. Today and tomorrow on the program, we're going to take a closer look at Keystone XL, the plan, the controversy, and the potential consequences if that pipeline is or is not built. Keystone XL, the North American oil boom, and what it means for gas prices, that's our cover story. Now, the first thing you need to know about the Keystone pipeline, it already exists.
Put your hand on it. Yeah, you can feel it going through there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that's all coming all the way from Canada.
Yes, it is.
This is the sound of Canadian heavy crude oil. For more than a year, it's been flowing south down the Keystone Pipeline from the Canadian tar sands in Alberta. It ends in Oklahoma in the small town of Cushing, population 7,000. And there, the oil is stored in massive tanks, hundreds of tanks scattered all across the town. Now, the pipeline that doesn't exist, the one you've heard all the debate about, is a second proposed pipeline. That's Keystone XL. It would be bigger than this pipeline, and it would follow a more direct route from Canada. The same company that built the first one wants to build the second. It's a company based in Calgary called TransCanada. Virgil Fenig is TransCanada's manager in Cushing, Oklahoma, and he showed us around last week.
So 500,000 barrels of oil a day or more can come through here.
Yes, that is correct.
Canada has the potential to produce more than 6 times the amount of oil it now makes. But because the existing pipeline ends in Oklahoma, Canada has no way to deliver its oil to refineries on the Gulf Coast and from there to the lucrative global oil market. That's what Keystone XL was supposed to resolve. And with one Keystone pipeline already pumping at full capacity, the second one wasn't supposed to be particularly controversial. But the project hit a snag, some 420 miles north of Cushing in the State House in Lincoln, Nebraska. TransCanada originally proposed running the XL pipeline through the sand hills of northern Nebraska. It's one of the most delicate ecosystems in the country, right above the massive Ogallala Aquifer. And that's where TransCanada ran into a ragtag coalition of environmentalists, cattle ranchers, Republicans, and Democrats who stood in the way.
Test 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Producer Brent Bachman and I traveled to Oklahoma and to Nebraska last week to find out more. Our first stop was to the office of the governor, Dave Heineman, a Republican.
And what do you recommend we eat in Nebraska?
You should go to a steakhouse.
Beef.
Beef. It's what's for dinner.
I had beef for lunch.
I'd have beef for dinner, too.
Nebraska is the third largest cattle state in the country. And a few years ago, it was small-scale cattle ranchers who began to raise concerns over the route of Keystone XL. Now, all pipelines, even the most advanced, like TransCanada's, eventually leak. And cattle ranchers feared that a leak along the Keystone XL pipeline could devastate the Ogallala Aquifer. It's one of the largest aquifers in America and a primary water source for farmers and ranchers in seven states who raise cattle, wheat, and corn. Governor Heineman sided with the ranchers in the Sandhills. So last August, he wrote a letter to President Obama asking him to deny TransCanada a permit to build Keystone XL.
When I wrote that letter, we were trying to get their attention to say, look, we don't want it to go through the Sandhills. And probably the only option at that time was to deny the permit if we had to go that far.
Heineman now says President Obama should have approved the pipeline, but conditionally, the condition that it wouldn't run through the Sandhills.
When you've got an 8.3% unemployment rate in America and we're trying to have energy independence, to me, this was a no-brainer. We should have moved forward with the project. And all he has to do is decide, is it in the national interest or not?
Now, supporters of the pipeline argue more oil from Canada means the U.S. would rely less on oil from places like Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. And TransCanada says the pipeline will create 20,000 direct jobs and thousands more related ones. Those figures are disputed by opponents. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. But what the company didn't expect was a man named Randy Thompson, now the most famous rancher in Nebraska.
Thanks so much.
Welcome to Nebraska.
Thank you. Thank you. We're delighted to be here.
Randy Thompson is a barrel-chested rancher who wears a white cowboy hat. He stuffed some tobacco inside his lower lip and showed us around.
There's one of my old longhorns right here. That's the one we butchered.
A bone-white longhorn skull is mounted on the barn door.
See what shot her in the head. Hell of a way to treat your pets, isn't it?
4 years ago, Thompson was contacted by an agency representing TransCanada.
I just got a call one day out of clear blue sky.
And that call?
He just said, well, there's a pipeline proposed, and it would possibly come across your land, and wonder if we could have permission to come on and do some surveying.
TransCanada wanted Thompson and all affected landowners to sign over the rights to part of their land in order to build the pipeline. Randy Thompson was offered $9,000, but he wasn't interested, so the company started to get aggressive. And in 2010, TransCanada sent a letter to his mother, who co-owned that land with him.
At the time, my mom was 92 years old, and she got this letter. You know, it says, you are by now aware that TransCanada Keystone Pipeline is constructing and will operate an 1,833-mile crude oil pipeline.
The letter goes on to read that if he refused to cooperate,
Keystone will use eminent domain to acquire the easement.
His first call was to his lawyer. The lawyer's advice? Cooperate. Eminent domain was nothing to mess around with, and if TransCanada was successful, Randy Thompson would receive less than favorable terms.
I got to tell you, I was sick when I got this letter. It keeps you up at night. And I've talked to a lot of landowners. Now, we're not used to dealing with this kind of stuff.
There are questions as to whether TransCanada even had the power to threaten eminent domain at the time. The letter suggests the pipeline project had been approved. Thompson was stunned that a foreign company could potentially take over his land. A TransCanada official, Robert Jones, says the company was simply following normal procedure.
The Keystone Pipeline system was under construction in 2010. We were absolutely considering the precedent in the past, anticipating a presidential permit shortly.
What bothered Thompson and other cattle ranchers in Nebraska was the tone of the letter. He felt it was unnecessarily aggressive. But in fact, similar letters sent to other landowners had the opposite effect.
I had a neighbor who told me, he said, these guys are way too big. He said, there's no need to fight them. He said, we just sign it and get it over with. So he signed the easement right away.
Right in the heart of the Sand Hills, about 4 hours northwest of Lincoln, Sue Luby, another cattle rancher, is getting ready for calving season. The water table on her land is so close to the surface, you only need to dig down 2 feet to hit the Ogallala Aquifer.
So, yeah, how does this work?
She has more than 40 water windmills on the ranch that pull the water into troughs for the cows to drink from. One afternoon 4 years ago, Sue Luby noticed an unusual sight in this part of Nebraska, a low-flying helicopter hovering over her land. Inside the cockpit, two surveyors working on behalf of TransCanada. The chopper terrified Luby's cattle and caused a stampede that sent them into a barbed wire fence, leaving some of the cows bloodied.
I got on the hood of my pickup and I pointed a rifle at them.
And they saw that?
Oh, yeah. I also gave them some sign language. They kind of understood, so they took off straight to the east as fast as they could go.
Sue Luby refused an offer of $18,000 to allow TransCanada to build the pipeline on her land. And like Randy Thompson, she got hooked up with a liberal group called Bold Nebraska, a group that made it its mission to stop the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah, so essentially, this is Bold Nebraska's office.
From the upper floor of a small building in downtown Lincoln, Jane Klebb heads up Bold Nebraska.
I think for some of us, you know, early on, maybe it was we were opposed to it through the San Jose of the Aquifer. But as we've seen TransCanada's behavior to landowners, we don't trust them.
So for now, Randy Thompson, Sue Luby, and other opponents of Keystone XL have won. TransCanada now says it will submit a new proposal to the U.S. government next year, a route, the company says, that won't go through the Sandhills. There was a time when that might have been good enough, but now Randy Thompson and other ranchers like him are convinced that the whole enterprise is bad for the environment and a raw deal for Nebraska. And he's become a symbol in the state. There are signs all across Nebraska that feature his face. They read simply, "I stand with Randy."
My parents didn't raise me to lay down and roll over for people. I mean, my folks got married in 1933, and they didn't raise a crop for 7 years in a row. They went through the drought, the depression, and they survived all that. And they were like in their 50s before they were ever able to buy a piece of land. And I'll tell you right now, that's what drives me, because I know what my folks went through to get a piece of ground. And these sons of come along and they tell me, we're going to take this land away from you, whether you want us to or not. And they got a fight on their hands.
Back in the state capital, Lincoln, Governor Heineman told us he's sympathetic, but only to a point.
And the fact of the matter is, we're still going to be using coal and oil for a long period of time. Hey, I'm a supporter that we need cleaner coal technology and those things, but it is not going to happen overnight. And in the meantime, I'd like to keep energy costs low for our citizens.
But how much of an impact will more Canadian oil flowing into the U.S. have on oil prices? And what about the environmental consequences? That's the subject of the second part of our report tomorrow on the program. In a moment, our economics correspondent John Itzde explains some of the reasons behind the sudden rise in gas prices. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Theologian Lauren Winner was 21 years old when she became a Christian. Although she was raised in a Jewish household and had converted to Orthodox Judaism just 2 years before, she says she always felt drawn to Christianity. Her surprising conversion was the subject of her first memoir, the bestseller Girl Meets God. But in Winner's new book, she writes about experiencing a spiritual crisis. It happened around the time her mother died and her marriage collapsed. Winner teaches Christian spirituality at Duke University and is also an ordained Episcopal priest. Her new book is called Still, Notes on a Mid-Faith Crisis. And she says that nothing could have prepared her for what amounted to a falling out with God.
In American Christianity, I think that we have a habit of telling our spiritual stories in a way that culminate in conversion. They culminate in the born-again experience, or they culminate in baptism.
It's where you're headed to naturally, you're saying.
Yes, the way that we, particularly American evangelicals, we know to tell the story of how we were far away from God and then we were born again, or then we came to know God, as though that were the end of the story. But I think that is actually only the prelude to the story. And in my life, I had this dramatic conversion to Christianity, and it had lots of intense emotions, and I thought that those feelings would just endure and that those feelings would sort of sustain me in the life of faith forever. And then I came to a place where I was no longer in the glow of the young adult new Christian conversion. I was now just in the middle of my faith life.
I mean, the journey you took to get to that point is a pretty extraordinary one. For people who don't know you, you wrote a memoir called Girl Meets God. And this was essentially about your conversion to Christianity. You had been raised Jewish. How did your family react to your decision?
Some of my Jewish relatives were decidedly unhappy about my conversion to Christianity. Over the years, I'm now 35, I have come to actually a place of real sorrow for the pain that my conversion has caused some members of my family. And, you know, I deeply regret that this thing that is central to my life, I mean, I wish it were otherwise. I wish that the thing that was so central to my life was not a source of ongoing pain for members of my family.
This memoir, of course, obviously deals with your struggles with faith, but two key moments, the death of your mother and the breakdown of your marriage, which is sort of in the background in this book, and you don't go into too many details. I don't want to pry.
Good.
There are obvious parallels with Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love. The circumstances are kind of similar, obviously, with the divorce. But she took a trip around the world, and you write, I just moved off the porch and went again to church. And you do go to church, even when you absolutely don't want to. Why'd you do it?
When everything else in my spiritual life was flagging, when I wasn't praying, when I wasn't believing anything, I did have some instinct that got me to church more often than not on a Sunday morning.
You tell a story about that time when you are going to church, and at certain times, you're very frank. I mean, you're annoyed by some of the people around you.
I was visiting Massachusetts one week and had a terrible week and didn't want to go to church and went to church. And as the service started, a woman sidled up to me and sat to my immediate left. And this woman looked like she had seen better days. And about halfway through the service, she started to tap her finger on the pew in front of us in a way that made it felt to me like the whole building was shaking. And I just was so annoyed that this woman was tapping the pew. And I glared at her and I hoped she would take the hint. And then I, you know, of course, without thinking, my left hand shot out and I placed my hand firmly over her tapping hand, you know, like a mother would still the tapping hand of a child. And of course, I was horrified that I had done this. And then I noticed that the woman didn't seem offended and wasn't shaking my hand off. And then I realized that she had actually begun to hold my hand. And we held hands for the rest of the service. And, you know, that was where I met Jesus that day, in that woman who converted my serious breach of etiquette into a moment of bodily communion and bodily intimacy. And I think it's probably a moment I will not ever forget.
It's writer Lauren Winner. Her new memoir is called Still, Notes on a Mid-Faith Crisis. She's also an assistant professor of Christian spirituality at Duke's Divinity School. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Oscars will be handed out this evening, and if you're planning to watch at home, what better snack to celebrate the film industry than popcorn? As Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf discovered, these days, popcorn goes far beyond plain or buttered.
Food critics call one brand the Rolls-Royce of popcorn and another the Prada, designer labels for the simplest, most American snack food. At the Winter Specialty Food Trade Show, gourmet popcorn was named one of the top five trends to watch. There's popcorn covered in chocolate, infused with bourbon. seasoned with curry. Flavor of the month at Popcornopolis in L.A., strawberries and cream. And if you want to make your own fancy popcorn, there are seasonings, chili, lime, dill pickle. And don't be surprised by the popcorn buffet at your next wedding. While popcorn may be trendy, it's hardly new. Archaeologists found ears of popcorn in New Mexico that may be 5,000 years old. Most Native Americans made popcorn long before the Europeans landed. The first settlers took to it right away, and some colonial families ate popcorn with sugar and cream for breakfast. Portable popcorn machines appeared at fairs and carnivals in the late 1800s. Then the vendors flocked to streets where Nickelodeons showed movies all day. When fancy movie palaces opened, the owners resented the tacky popcorn tracked on the plush carpets of their grand staircases. The Great Depression was popcorn's big break. Cash-strapped movie theaters lowered their standards, brought concessions inside, and a star was born. World War II sugar rations sent popcorn sales into the stratosphere. Without candy, Americans ate three times as much popcorn as usual. Then television lured people away from the movies. By the 1950s, people were popping corn in their kitchens. Popcorn, without the chocolate and saturated fat, also plays a starring role as a health food, low in calories and fat, and high in fiber. Americans eat 16 billion quarts of popcorn a year. That's 52 quarts per person. And most of the world's popcorn grows in the U.S. We love our popcorn. Certainly a performance worthy of a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Bonnie Wolf is the author of Talking With My Mouth Full and contributing editor of NPR's Kitchen Window. She's also on Twitter at Bonnie Wolf. This is NPR News.